Lovely to be here with you all this morning. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only shining light. In all of my life. Within and without.
And everywhere about.
Peace, bliss. Amen. Sent out a health update this morning, dear friends. Thought I'd read it to you. Events have continued to unfold at a quick pace. After it was discovered that another tumor had grown on the liver, I was referred to for TIL, or Tumor Infiltrating Lymphocytes Therapy, at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. The research doctor at SCCA referred me to a liver specialist surgeon at the U of W. And after a tumor board review, I am scheduled for surgery this Friday. The surgeon will do a liver resection, removing part of the liver and the tumor. After much discussion, he also recommended taking out the gallbladder, since I had gallstones, and the liver resection will leave scar tissue, making any further operation in this area difficult. The gallbladder holds a reserve of gall that is used for digestion, especially to break down fats. Good news is the liver is one of the few organs that will regenerate itself in adults, and the liver will respond to the gallbladder's absence by producing more gall. T cells will be gathered from the tumor, and we should know in 5 weeks whether they have been successful in growing new T cells. If so, the T-cells will be frozen for possible future use. My naturopath is in agreement with the treatment protocols outlined. I will continue with his supplements after the operation. I have suspended most of them now until the operation so that they will not interfere with the surgery. Surgery is scheduled for Friday, June 3rd, 7:30 a.m. I will be in the hospital 3 to 4 days. My physical condition is vastly superior to when I went into surgery in December. I am stronger in every way, and I feel the healing of your prayers. I have been in the grip of God, as His divine force has been powerfully moving through this form, taking me upstairs much of the time. So I have not been able to respond to all emails. As always, I love hearing from you. However, if I do not get back to you right away, you will know why. And from Master, Perfect Father, thy light is flowing through Christ, through the saints of all religions, through the masters of India, and through me. This divine light is present in all my body parts. I am well. And from Master, conscious breathlessness is deathlessness. Breath is life. You can do without breath. You can control life. Prolong it and rise above it to soul while living. In order to be without breath, you cannot start by forcing or suppressing it in the lungs. You have to watch it. This is the preliminary method. You can practice this lesson anytime. Sit erect wherever you are with a little forward chest and relax. Close your eyes or direct both of your half-opened eyes toward the center of the eyebrows. With the greatest calmness, feel your breath naturally going in and coming out. As the breath goes in, mentally chant without moving your tongue, Hong, H-O-N-G. As it goes out, mentally chant the word Sa, S-A-U. Do not in any way use mental willingness or force to let the breath in or out. While practicing this, have the calm attitude that you are a silent observer of your natural breath coming in and going out, of which you are not generally conscious. With the greatest reverence and attention, practice this. The longer, the better. You can do it at leisure time, during the day or night. You will feel the greatest calmness in you and by revitalize yourself as soul, superior to and existing independently of this material body. Hong means soul. Sa means the great spirit. Hong means soul. Sa means the great spirit. Always sit on a chair, a straight chair, with a woolen blanket placed over it and running down under the feet. Face the east and sit erect without touching the back of the chair with your back. You ought to practice this method during your leisure periods, too. When you are on the bus or the trolley car or sitting anywhere doing nothing, just watch the breath and mentally chant Hong Sa. So this is the most wonderful practice. I've also translated Hong Sa to mean I am. So with each breath, you're affirming the I am. And you're also bringing the soul into spirit and surrendering it into spirit with each and every breath. The greatest things in life are oftentimes the simplest things. And these are not to be overlooked. This is a powerful technique. Master said that it was the mini Kriya, and it had the capacity to take you all the way to God realization. Anytime you feel anxious, anytime there is any disturbance at all to your mental state of peace, simply put your mind onto the Hong Sa, and you will find peace. You will be relaxed in the body. Your breath will automatically regulate, and along with it, your mind and whatever is disturbing you will begin to dissipate, and gradually it will be extinguished in the sacred chant of Hong Sa. So do not forget it. Make it a practice. It's easy to do. We have been privileged to have some powerful techniques given to us. Mother also taught us the Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram that Papa chanted. And these two can be used in conjunction with each other, one at a time, of course. But by chanting the name of God, by chanting the Hong Sa, you will be brought into that highest state of consciousness. Now, if that state of consciousness is not being achieved, you have to have a little bit of a firm talk to yourself. Because that's what this is all about. It's all about a God experience. And if you're not having God experience, you're not getting it. You're not practicing. There's no excuses, really. Those times that are difficult, those are the times we need it the most. And as we know, we're most likely to forget those things that really benefit us when we are under stress. We let go of those things. Instead, we train the mind to turn to God. When more do we need Him than then? I was reading through what has become a classic by Ralph Waldo Emerson, and this is on compensation. It's a very interesting, it's a discussion of karma, really. But I'd like to read you a little bit of it. Ever since I was a boy, I have wished to write a discourse on compensation, for it seemed to me that when very young, that on this subject, life was ahead of theology, and the people knew more than the preachers taught. The documents, too, from which the doctrine is to be drawn, charm my fancy by their endless variety, and lay always before me, even in sleep. For they are the tools in our hands, the bread in our basket, the transactions of the street, the farm and the dwelling house, greetings, relations, debts and credits, the influence of character, the nature and endowment of all men. It seemed to me also that it might be shown men a ray of divinity, the present action of the soul of this world, clean from all vestige of tradition. So the heart of man might be bathed by an inundation of eternal love, conversing with that which he knows was always and always must be, because it is really is now. It appeared, moreover, that if this doctrine could be stated in terms with any resemblance to those bright intuitions in which this truth is sometime revealed to us, it would be a star in many dark hours and crooked passages in our journey. That would not suffer us to lose our way. I was lately confirmed in these desires by hearing a sermon at church. The preacher, a man esteemed for his orthodoxy, unfolded in the ordinary manner the doctrine of the Last Judgment. He assumed that judgment is not executed in this world, that the wicked are successful and the good are miserable, and then urged from reason and from Scripture a compensation to be made to both parties in the next life. No offense appeared to be taken by the congregation at this doctrine. As far as I could observe, when the meeting broke up, they separated without remark on the sermon. Yet, what was the import of this teaching? What did the preacher mean by saying that the good are miserable in the present life? Was it that houses and lands, offices, wine, horses, dress, luxury are had by unprincipled men, whilst the saints are poor and despised, and that a compensation is to be made to these last hereafter by giving them the like gratifications another day, bank stocks and doubloons, venison and champagne? This must be the compensation intended. For what else? Is it that they are to have leave to pray and praise, to love and serve men? Why, they can do so now. The legitimate inference the disciple would draw was, we are to have such a good time as the sinners have now. Isn't that wonderful? We are to have such a good time as the sinners have now. Or to push it to its extreme import, you sin now, we shall sin by and by. And we would sin now if we could. Not being successful, we expect our revenge tomorrow. The fallacy lay in the immense concession that the bad are successful, that justice is not done now. The blindness of the preacher consisted in deferring to the base estimate of the market of what constitutes a manly success, instead of confronting and convicting the world from the truth, announcing the presence of the soul, the omnipotence of the will, and so establishing the standard of good and ill, of success and falsehood. I find a similar bass tone in popular religious works of the day, and the same doctrines assumed by the literary men when occasionally they treat the related subjects. I think that our popular theology has gained in decorum and not in principle. over the superstitions it has displaced. But men are better than their theology. Their daily life gives it the lie. Every ingenious and inspiring soul leaves the doctrine behind him in his own experience, and all men feel sometimes the falsehood which cannot be demonstrated. For men are wiser than they know. That which they hear in schools and pulpits without afterthought, if said in conversation, would probably be questioned in silence. If a man dogmatized in a mixed company on providence and the divine laws, he is answered by silence, which conveys well enough to an observer the dissatisfaction of the hearer, but his incapacity to make his own statement. I shall attempt in this and the following chapter to record some facts that indicate the path of the law of compensation. Happy beyond my expectation if I shall truly draw the smallest arc of this circle. Polarity, or action and reaction, we meet in every part of nature, in darkness and light, in heat and cold, in the ebb and flow of waters, in male and female, in the inspiration and expiration of plants and animals, in the equation and quantity and quality of the fluids of the animal body, in the systole and diastole of the heart, in the undulations of fluids of the sound, in the centrifugal and centripetal gravity, in electricity, galvanism, and chemical affinity. Superinduced magnetism at one end of a needle. The opposite magnetism takes place at the other. If the south attracts, the north repels. To empty here, you must condense there. An inevitable dualism bisects nature so that each thing is a half and suggests the other thing to make it whole. As spirit, matter, man, woman, odd, even, subjective, objective, in, out, upper, under, motion, rest, yea, nay. So he goes on to talk about the dualism of this world and the many ways in which you find it. But I find it most interesting here that in an inevitable dualism bisects nature so that each thing is a half and suggests another thing to make it whole. So this is the truth, really. All of this world, all of this universe and creation is full. It's complete. It's whole and it's one. And yet we're constantly trying to bisect it. We're trying to divide it up. We only want that which is good. We only want that which is easy. We only want that which satisfies the senses. And yet life presents us so much more. And we feel as if we have been wronged by life if it gives us something that's distasteful to us, that we don't like, that creates some difficulty. And this is the thing, this is the thing that we hang on to that makes us really miserable. It makes us lose out on the greatest gift that we have in this life, and that is to see the wholeness of everything and that it is all good. When God created this vast universe and more, he looked upon it, so to speak, and he said, it is good. Now, if we were to take God at his word, then we would have to look out at this world and not just say that part of it is good, but that the whole of it is good. The fact that there are things that happen that we don't understand its place in nature, why these things happen, is just simply the limits of our vision. For the tree that falls in the woods and goes to its death as it dissolves back into the earth, it may not feel the justice of its life. It may feel sorrow at the losing of its life. But as we walk through the woods and we see this log now become a nursery, that there are all these little seeds that have turned into saplings that have started to sprout up. And as a result of that, new life comes into being and it's feeding on the death of this old tree. And we can see the beauty of it. We can see the wonder of it. It's something that's really magnificent if we stop and think about it. And so this cycle of life is constantly going on all around us. And if we see it with the higher vision, with the truer vision, we see that it all serves a purpose. Even pain, even suffering, even difficulties, it's all there if we have the eyes to see it and the ears to hear it. Now, this doesn't mean that it makes it easy, that we do not deserve the compassion of others, or that we do not give compassion to others when there is suffering. No doubt this is a difficult time to go through. But when we turn our attention to God, we lift up beyond just the dualism of this world. We see this world with brand new eyes. And as we do, we see that everything has its place. There is a purpose behind it. Now, even if we go out and we are deliberately foolish, we do things that go against nature's and God's laws, even that will ultimately serve a good, because contained within that ignorance is also the wisdom. And the wisdom will eventually come as we suffer the consequence of those things that we do that go against those laws. And we may have to go through it many, many times, but gradually the pain of the effect of what we're doing wakens us up to the wisdom that is naturally occurring inside of us. This is a terrific thing to know, because then we are unafraid. We're unafraid of the things that this world brings to us. We know that God's presence is with us always. That supreme presence that lifts us up beyond the things of this world. This is why meditation is so essential. It goes beyond the mind. The mind is always in a state of creation, but it is always in a state of dualism. They can't escape it. The only way that we can go beyond it is to, so to speak, die to the mind, die to this life. Die to the things that we normally cling on to or that we are desperately trying to push away. We rise above it. We simply take a mantra such as Hong Sa. We put the mind to work on it. Papa told that wonderful story where the man who wished had so many desires, and he searched and searched, and finally he found someone who would give him a mantra in which he could conjure up the devil who would satisfy all of his desires. And so the man went to work and he did this mantra, and after 28 days, the devil appeared to him. And he said, "Yes, my son, what can I do for you?" And he says, "Oh, I have so many desires. I want you to grant them all." And the devil said, "Well, yes, I'll do that. With one caveat," he said, "when your desires run out, then you are mine." Well, the man thought, "I have so many desires, I'll never run out of them." So he started asking the devil to do this and that and the other thing. First, there was a palace, and the devil went out, and within a remarkably short amount of time, he said, "Let me show you your palace." And he had created this palace right out of the ether. And he showed him all the beauties of it. Then he wanted lands, and he wanted servants, and he wanted so many things, and it just kept going and going and going. But one day he woke up, and he had an odd thought. He says, "I can't think of one more thing that I want." And he started to panic. And he thought up a few things for the devil to do, but he knew he was in real trouble. So he went down the road. And fortunately, as you all know, in India, you can find a saint who's down the road, and he found one. And he said, "Sir, I've gotten myself into a real pickle here, and you have to help me." And he said, "My son, this is a grievous thing that you've done. If you will follow my instructions exactly, and once having done so, you come and you learn the higher teachings that will give you lasting and true happiness, then I will give you the solution." The man was so desperate, he instantly agreed. And so he said, this is what you do. So then he got his instructions and off he went. And sure enough, the devil came to him and he knew that the man was running out of desires. He just knew that it was right on the cusp and he would have him. So he said with a smile, my son, what would you like now? And he said, I have a task for you. He says, I want you to get a pole. Instantly, a pole appeared. He said, now I want you to run up and down that pole, up and down, up and down, up and down. You keep going until I tell you to stop. So the devil started to run up and down and up and down. And the man left and he went and he sat at the saint's feet. And there he took in the teachings that would teach him about real happiness. Eventually, the devil got tired of running up and down and he ran away. And never bothered the man again. So this is our mantra that we take. We run it up and down. We run the mind up and down the pole. And the devil, who is his constant desire, constantly egging us on, constantly unrest, and eventually he will get tired and he will run away and we are left in peace. So we have to go beyond the things of this world. We really do. It's not an easy task. We're very addicted to this world. We're very addicted to its good and the things that we want. But, oddly enough, we are also very addicted to its evil. You think about people who gossip, people who will focus on what is terrible. You're driving along in a road and there's an accident. And everybody stops to look, where are the bodies, where's the blood, where's the... It's an odd thing, isn't it? We're attracted to it. We want to see it. And so this is the way that it is in life. And we're just as attracted to the bad and the negative as we are to the good and the positive. You can't have one without the other. If somebody has a lot of anger, inevitably, you will discover that there is a lot of fear that is behind the anger. Otherwise, why the anger, the push for activity and dominance? It is because there is fear that is driving that anger. For somebody who is hungry, there is also being satiated because they have this in their mind. They want that filled up feeling. And so everything carries its opposite already embedded in it. Somebody who is very greedy, they will get and get and get, and yet that hole of greed will never be satisfied because what they have they know can be taken away, or that somebody has something more than what they have. And so this unrest is constantly at work inside of them. So it is built in. Sometimes you look at somebody else's life and you think, oh, if I only had their life. And they're looking at somebody else's life and say, oh, if I only had their life. And on it goes. Where is the satisfaction? Where is the peace? Where is the contentment in the here and now? It's only when we let go of our likes and our dislikes. This is a primary teaching by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. It is our attachment to these opposites. It's also the teachings of the Buddha. And even Jesus talked about all of the things that come and go. And sometimes he's talking about the love of God, and sometimes he's talking about the fierceness of God. I'd like to read you from Papa, The Divine Life. And I asked Papa to guide me to something to read today. And I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was unusual for him. The world as we now see it can be broadly divided into two camps, one striving to bring about universal peace and friendship, and the other preparing for a tremendous struggle for destruction on a vast scale. The universal love in the view of those who advocate it refers, in fact, The universal love, in the view of those who advocate it, refers in fact only to such of the people who subscribe to the cult of friendship and peace. Harsh and very often intolerant criticism and condemnation are hurled at the opponents of peace by the votaries of universal love. Here, love, which presumes to be only nonviolent and forgiving in nature, is not behind hand in raising a revolt against those who seek to create disorder in the life of humanity. The people who advocate peace would surely not have friendly communion and intercourse with the protagonists of war. Though not on the physical plane, a stiff mental warfare is actually going on between those two opponents. The ferocious animal, tiger, in brutally destroying the life of other animals, is at the same time friendly and loving towards its young ones and of its own kind. This may be equally true of the people of the opposing camps. Whether by thought, word, or action, we have to admit that there is a ceaseless war going on in the heart of humanity. Now, what is needed on the part of a real spiritual hero is to stand up on behalf of righteousness, that is, of those who are struggling to reach the inner harmony and peace of the immortal spirit and adjust the eternal life accordingly, and then fight with all the opposing influences from whatever direction they come, with a brave and unflinching heart, either by thought, word, or action. We are afraid of physical action, while we are not so when we try to put down the opposing force by violent thought or word. This distinction is invidious and not in keeping with the realization of the highest truth. Love is not weak, halting, or a cowardly thing. It is ever bold, forward, and heroic. No good comes by shilly-shallying with the sense of this sublime word. We admit God is love, but we are at wit's end as we know how to explain or account for the work of destruction that is going on a gigantic scale in the universe about us, emanated as it is from such a God who is the sole controller of all the forces that mold and remold the destinies of the worlds. The truth is, God is pure, impersonal love, and those who take refuge in him are saved, and those who are against him perish. We are preaching universal love with the object of awakening mankind to the realization of its indwelling cosmic spirit, who is one. We must not forget that we are at the same time invoking in nature a mighty and all-devouring power that would spell ruin and disaster to humanity. To set up this malevolent force and then to sit quiet, taking refuge in the cult of nonviolence and non-resistance, is sheer imprudence and cowardice. The eternal fight between the self and not-self, between the altruistic and selfish impulse in mankind, has an inevitable place in the play of nature. Ours is to side with the former and wage war on the latter until the last breath leaves our body, as much on the physical plane as on the mental plane. If we dare face truth, let us do so preparing ourselves for any fate. Man is a fighter by nature's own gift. Let us then fight having God, who is love, as our goal, transcending all the weakening influences of the gunas or the modes of prakriti. Let us start a world crusade against tyranny, arrogance, pride, and oppression, wherever it is found. The earth is groaning beneath the heavy and heartless tread of men drunk with brute power and authority. A tame philosophy of flowery words and smooth phrases is not the demand of the time spirit. Its message is a call for concerted action, charged with firmness and determination. Powerful words. And it puts in front of us the conundrum that many of us face. We want this world to be at peace. We want this world and everybody in it just to get along. But we don't want to face those things, those oppressors, those tyrants, when we see them. They may be in a social circle. They may be somebody who is saying things without anybody really saying anything about it. Just as Emerson went to see this preacher, and this man said some things that were really, if you think about it and take it to its obvious conclusion as he did, really quite volatile words, and yet nobody had any real thought about it. They just took it as if it's, yes, that's of course, that's the way that it is. We are votaries of truth. We are votaries of love. And we have to be able to stand up to those who are working counter to that. There are times, and I have met those people, who talk about peace in this world, but they will have their favorite straw men that they set up, and with viciousness and such anger, attack those people. And yet they're talking about having peace in this world, but they have none in their own hearts. This cannot be. You cannot be husbanding that kind of anger and have peace in your life. It doesn't work that way. We have to find peace first. We have to be willing to encounter those forces that are inside of us. Now, sometimes those forces come as a whispering voice. They tell us, oh, don't meditate tonight. You've worked so hard today. You don't have time for that. Why don't you sit in front of the television for a while and just watch that today? And that'll be your relaxation. That'll be your reward for today. Or for others, it may be taking alcohol or it may be taking drugs of any sort in order to find that calm, in order to find that peace, that joy that they're seeking out. But they are so not able to be able to accomplish that goal. They don't get any real peace at the bottom of a bottle. They don't get any real joy from it. They don't get what they are really looking for, so they keep going after it again and again, and yet coming up empty. So in our own life and in those lives of those people around us, we don't have to necessarily confront every person that we see, but in our minds, we are absolutely glued to the truth. We know what we know. And there may be those times when we do stand up, when we do say something, when we do fight against tyranny or oppression. Tyranny can come in many different ways. And sometimes it's from a loved one. And yet their oppressive kind of environment that they create is so pressing down on everybody else, and nobody says anything, nobody does anything. Because that personality will lash out at you if you do. And so there are times when we stand up for the truth. There are times when we stand up for the light. We're unafraid. Papa said here that invoking this universal love, it may create worldwide destruction. Mother talked about that as well, that there may come a great conflict in time. As the truth seeks to express itself, the universalizing truth, and there will be those who react against it, try to quell it, perhaps with death, perhaps with harsh words, perhaps with threats of various kinds. So in order to be fearless in this life, we have to adhere to God alone. We have to know that in Him, we already have victory. We already have comfort. We already have truth and light, everything that we need, that we will never find it in this world. And the world may strip us of everything. It may strip us of everything. Think of the life of Jesus and how it stripped him of everything in a human and material sense. That he said himself, the Son of Man must die, in order for there to be a spiritual regeneration, in order for the Son of God to fully ascend unto the Father, to come into the highest state of consciousness. If we live in the shadow of fear, it is a darkness that will take us over. If we summon the courage, not just from ourselves, but from reaching out to God and knowing that he is with us always, then we will have conquered that fear, and we will never have to face it again in that sense that it will dominate us. This is the truth, and we must really go to work on ourselves. If we are not experiencing God experience continuously, we have not yet achieved our goal as of yet. And so we can't just coast along, because coasting is part of that opposing force, and it'll naturally coast right into the realm of darkness and separation from God. We must turn our shoulder to the wheel and really do the work. Now, God experience is the most wonderful thing that we can possibly imagine. It takes us beyond the dualism of this world. It takes us past the likes and dislikes and makes us know that God is ever with us, that the bliss and joy and peace of his Spirit are not dependent upon situations in this world, but is always available to us. It is such a tempting thought to think, oh, well, later in life, then I'll be able to stop and relax and enjoy. Then I'll really get in and do my sadhana then. But does it happen? I don't see it happening. People get older and they don't press on more. They get distracted with other things. Retired people will say, I never knew how I found time to work. I'm so busy. And on it goes. The world has its demands, and we have to respond to this world. We live in it. That's true. But to the exclusion of God, never. God comes first. God comes first, middle, and last. And everything else that we do in this life is all an expression of his service in this world. So let us watch our temper. Let us watch our desire nature. Let us watch these things that can take us away from where we need to be. It doesn't mean that you don't work for a better life for yourself and for others. Of course you do. But first and foremost, God is with you. And whether you live in a tiny little shack or you live in a large mansion, it's all the same. It's all the same because God is in both. And if you're absent of God in one, you're probably going to be absent of him in another. And remember, when we look out onto this world, whatever that person is doing that may upset us, the opposite is also with them. It cannot be otherwise. And they have to live with that. They have to live with it. I know people who have done things, terrible things sometimes, in order to earn wealth and acclaim in this world. But I can tell you they have no real peace and happiness. They have their victories. They think of themselves as successful. But deep down underneath, there is no real success, because their victories have been built upon shambles. And it's not really theirs. It's only when we have victory in God that we have true and lasting happiness. So let us strive for that. Let us not forget it. Let's go deeper. Let's soar higher. It's all there. It's all there right within you. So let us take a moment now, feeling God's great presence, breathing in with each breath, the great I Am, the great soul and spirit, the I Am, the true you, the true self who is beyond the things of this world. Whatever you may have walked in here with, let it go, let it drop from you. Go inside, particularly in the heart center. As you breathe, feel the action of your lungs. As your lungs expand, think the holy word, Hong. As you breathe out, sacred word, Sa. I Am. Feel the deep peace within you. A joy that bubbles up from the depth of your soul. A light that emanates from your whole being. And let that light go out to this world. To both whom you might consider good or evil. And see all saturated in that divine light. See this world as God sees it. That it's in transition. It's growing toward God consciousness. So much of it is caught up in the polarity, the likes and dislikes. But we're all children who are striving for God. And God sees that. And where this one and that one opens to Him, He pours Himself into them, even as He pours Himself into you. Feel that life, that joy, that peace, that light. And let it flow out to this whole world. Wouldn't it be wonderful to live in that state of consciousness now and always? There's nothing that stops it, nothing at all, except our own minds turning away from it. All are the children of God. Mother Hamilton told Mother Teresa of Calcutta, Mother, I have no sinners in my congregation. Some of them are naughty, some of them are good, but they're all God's kids. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Amen. Pranam, I bow to the light within you.